I do try to meditate on my mistakes more than on my successes. And the reason I do that is I genuinely subscribe to this mantra that only the paranoid survive.
Hey folks, this is Abe Shreve. Welcome to the Choose Difficult podcast. The path to success is not easy, and here we explore the stories of those who choose difficult and change the world they live in. Today, I am really honored to introduce you to a great friend of mine. His name is Alex Maslov. He's the CEO and co-founder of a company called North Fork Composites and Edge Rods by Gary Loomis. Now, if there is any part of you that likes fishing, whether it's fly fishing or deep sea fishing, whatever it is, your heart just jumped a little bit when I said Gary Loomis. He is a legend in the fishing industry. He was the first to create the carbon fiber fishing rod, which is now today the standard. A number of years ago, I went with some friends on a fishing trip to Christmas Island. It's this teeny little atoll in the equatorial Pacific, like dead in the middle of it. Alex was on that trip, and we became fast friends. We bonded over catching all manner of sea creatures, but the real bond, what kept us in contact, were the incredible conversations around our families, being husbands and fathers and entrepreneurs. In fact, I was blessed to take my entire family to the Edge Rods facilities up in Oregon. And while we were there, it was a brand new manufacturing facility. Alex let us know they've already outgrown it, and it was brand new. He is constantly innovating. In fact, Alex told me that when he purchased the company, he walked in and he asked everyone, "What do we do?" And the predominant answer was, "We create fishing rods." And he said, I looked around and I said, "It looks to me like we build things out of carbon fiber tubes." He moved here to the United States when he was 7 years old with his entire family. He grew up in a little teeny country called Moldova. It's nestled right between Romania, Bulgaria, and Ukraine, right against the Black Sea. And after the fall of the former Soviet Republic, they were able to bring their entire family to the United States seeking asylum. His father was a well-known preacher minister, had articles published, and because of his status, they were granted asylum in the United States, and here they are. We pick up the story when Alex is in his early 20s and he starts at a small little company called Amazon.
Amazon was one of the largest recruiters in town. At the time that I started working, there were only a couple thousand employees, and they were hiring for their health and baby department. And they, by mercy, grace, whatever you want to call it, they took a chance on a small young kid who knew very little about business and very little about the internet, but knew a little bit about medicine, was a hard worker, and said, "Hey, you know what? We're hiring for this health and baby beauty department that we don't really know what we're going to do. And we'd like to give you an offer." And I said, "Yes." By the way, I repaid their love and generosity and kindness by deep down thinking that they will never, ever, ever, ever sell anything more than books. And I left that company very, 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 very early on with a lot of stock options unexercised on the table.
It's hard to believe that Amazon was ever small, right? I mean, if you had those stock options today, can you even imagine what they would be worth? But really, for people like Alex, and I would like to believe people like me, and I think people like you listening to this podcast, it really isn't just about accumulating stuff and even accumulating wealth. The journey to it is just as important. Alex said that his parents had other plans for him. They didn't seek this entrepreneurial life for him. They had other ideas.
My dad wanted me to be a youth pastor very early on. And I, was very active within, the church community growing up. And I realized that that really wasn't for me. It's a little bit of a longer journey. And then my mom really wanted me to be a doctor. So first I failed as a youth pastor. Then I failed as a doctor. And I realized later on in life that there are other ways to help people aside from, being on the spiritual side of things or on the medical side of things. And, now I happily employ about 60 people. And I like to think that, I help them in all of their walks of life. But at that time, I absolutely, I think, ruined my dad's day by not becoming a pastor and then ruined my mom's day by not becoming a doctor.
While Alex was at Amazon, he worked on projects that you and I today would think have just existed forever. But back then, they were just discovering how to place the buttons on the sales page. Like, it was all new. And he was right there at the forefront of it.
I worked there for about 2 years. And what I ended up being responsible for was analyzing all of the web traffic that was coming to the Amazon home store
from various sources all over the internet, whoever their associate partners were at the time, whether it was, you know, Digital Pixel Review or various affiliate sites. So we would analyze that traffic, we would analyze the whatever's happening with whatever sales trajectory that was going on at the time. And, you know, we would make decisions like, you know, moving the buy button a couple of centimeters down on the page and it would drastically affect purchase results, or, you know, the color of the, so I mean, I'm talking early days of Amazon, you know, not the first year or the second year, but I think maybe they were about the fifth or the sixth year in existence at the time. So still very, very young, still, you know, growing. But, you know, the wonderful thing about working with people at both Amazon and Microsoft is everybody is a lot smarter than you are. So you are drinking from a fire hose every single day. You know, the amount of analytics that you learn in a MBA class or in school doesn't compare to the people that are working around you in a big corporation like that, because, you know, they've forgotten more things than a lot of people will see in an analytics class. So I'm talking, you know, writing full-on SQL queries to mine raw data out of you know, whatever database somebody's created to digitally figure out that, you know, if you put beer next to diapers, your beer sales are going to shoot up, right? And I'm using that allegorically because, you know, there are bundles that sell, and, you know, there's a science that happens in retail, which, you know, I did later on, but, you know, selling products, two complementary products that really drive not just, you know, bundle sales, revenue, margin. I mean, you learn so much, which is just, you can't learn if you're not doing it. You know, it's, somebody can only tell you about this stuff, but you have to live through it to be able to understand
it. It was during this period of Alex's life that he was approached by a recruiter from Microsoft, and he was intrigued by what they were offering and made the jump.
Microsoft had this amazing program, and a recruiter reached out through somebody that I knew where they would select about 13 individuals nationally from all the colleges all over the place, and they would put you into a kind of a management development program, and they would rotate you. Now, get this. This is how amazing this was. You could pick whatever part of the company you'd want to work in. So, you know, for me, treasury was fascinating for me. So I worked in treasury risk. You know, server and tools was fascinating for me. So I worked in server and tools. And they would rotate you from department to department to department. And, you know, I worked in insurance risk, you know, underwriting whatever their policy risks were. And I got to live in Ireland and in Paris. So the thing is, they would rotate you from department to department until you could really figure out what you wanted to do. And after a number of years, I said, look, I want to do sales operations. That's kind of what I feel that my strength is in. I know that I have a finance degree and understand numbers. I can handle the analytics, but really what I love to do is I love the relationship aspect part of business, and sales ops is for me. And I said, great, do you speak Russian? I said, yes, I do. I said, pack your bags, you're going to Russia.
Alex would move his family to Russia and oversee all retail operations for Microsoft. Think of that. That's a big, big thing for a family to move them to a different country. Alex has a wonderful wife named Veronica. He told me that the very first loan he ever took was for the ring that would take her off the market. In fact, he told me he married way out of his class. I've met Veronica. He's right. But that's exactly what people say when they meet Teresa and I. Veronica was successful in her own right. She had a career going, and this move and others would require sacrifice. Of course, it'd be a sacrifice, but I don't know that she ever could have been fully prepared for the sacrifice that was coming.
She also worked at Amazon, but she's an internal auditor. She worked for Deloitte. She worked for Ernst & Young. I believe she worked for Pricewaterhouse, but I'm not sure. So, you know, one of the great things about marriage is you got to make some sacrifices sometimes. And one of the most awesome things that she did is, as we kept traveling around, she kept finding new roles within these multinational corporations as I was moving. So she would work in, you know, internal audit. She would work in assurance. She would work in consulting at these various big four firms as I was trying to figure out who I wanted to be when I grew up. As a reward for her, many, many years later, I told her that I'm going to spend our life savings to buy a company out of bankruptcy. And I just figured that's the best way to reward her for all the sacrifice that she's made.
Alex was a rising star in any company that he worked in. But he and I share something in common. And I believe this is common among all entrepreneurs. That is, the moment you feel that security has set in, that business as usual is set, that you kind of know the way this is going to go, you freak out and burn your world to the ground. I mean, really, in a nutshell, that's how you would describe entrepreneurs. They want to live on the cutting edge of building something big and not just being a part of a machine.
As amazing as all these companies are, I think at one point, if you have the entrepreneurial bug, it will start to gnaw on you on the inside. And phenomenal companies, great managers I had, you know, and there's a reason why they're so big and as good as they are. But at one point, you just start feeling like a cog in a giant wheel. And it's not to say that, you know, I didn't have enough end-to-end of responsibility. I did, but I wanted something more out of whatever I was doing in my daily business life. And I can tell you that probably if I was a lot older when that happened, I wouldn't have made the choices that I've made. But, you know, I'm here now. So I like to say that, look, I was young and stupid, and I really didn't realize how good I had it either at Amazon or Microsoft. But there's something urging you on the inside to, you know, it's this sense that you're running out of time. And not in the sense that, you know, you're getting older, but the sense that you're running out of time to accomplish something. And it was a feeling that I would go to sleep with. It was a feeling that I would wake up with. So I loved what I did for Amazon and Microsoft. But as I progressed through my career and got more senior, I still felt unfulfilled. And, you know, oddly enough, it's this type of fulfillment that you feel as an entrepreneur when a machine breaks down and you're laying underneath it, elbow deep in oil, never have performed any maintenance on a machine ever before. But it's this tiredness, happiness that comes from, you know, completing something that, you know, is your own, which is, it's an odd way to say it, but it's as best as I can describe that feeling that kind of washes over you.
All right, listen up. Alex is about to drop some gold. There are plenty of entrepreneurs in the world that choose to be in business for themselves for flexibility and ease of schedule. I'm not talking to you right now. You're going to be out of business. I'm talking to everybody else. I'm talking to those that wake up every day thirsty and start running. Alex said that in a very competitive space, they have to stay on the cutting edge. And so he has a favorite quote that hangs on the wall in every one of their facilities.
I borrowed it from, I think, one of the most amazing leaders that started Intel, and his story is very similar to mine as being a survivor of what happened with the Holocaust. But Andy Groves coined this, and I actually asked our folks to memorize it, and we have it on our office. And it's something so deeply profound. It says that every company has within it the seeds to its own destruction. Success breeds complacency. Complacency breeds failure. Only the paranoid survive. And it's not this paranoia where you are, you know, afraid. It's this paranoia where you are relentless. You know, it's this, you know that there's always going to be change. You know that change is constant. You know that it's ongoing. You know that it's happening. And you know that if you don't adjust with it, you're going to fall into that trap of I'm successful, now I'm mediocre, and now suddenly I'm a failure. So it's not a bad paranoia is what I like to tell people. It's this paranoia where you are refusing to become complacent in whatever you're doing.
My partner in this business, Gary Keller, has said to me many times, Abe, your job is to figure out what is the business that puts your business out of business and then go create that. You're either moving forward or you're being passed. I really believe that's at the heart of what Alex is teaching us. I asked Alex, what did you learn going through the process to purchase this company?
You only know what you know when you are looking at financials and when you are, you know, looking at whatever due diligence that you're doing. And there's a reason that, you know, companies spend a lot of money on due diligence, investigating, you know, who the founders are, investigating, you know, financial information, hiring consultants. Very early on, you know, it's this feeling that I overvalued myself, that, hey, I know a lot more than I really do. I know financials. I know how to read financial statements. And, you know, there is, one of it makes financial sense. The second challenge was, you know, it's very hard to know what's going to happen with various personnel that are inside of the company. And that relates to, you know, contract law, that relates to, you know, various trademarks that you may have. We've been through a number of trademark disputes with Shimano in the past. And, you know, they are a company that purchased Gary's earlier brands. And this is something that you can't predict. You know, you can't predict, you know, who may sue you. You can't predict, you know, which key employees may leave because they don't agree with your mission and your vision. So, you know, I would say you're going to do all the due diligence that you can. But at the end of the day, anytime when you're purchasing a company, it's going to be especially a small company, it's going to be incredibly difficult in the very beginning. And difficult, not just because, you know, you're trying to mold the company according to what you think your mission and vision of the company is, but people also have opinions. And, you know, oftentimes at first, when I came into the company, I was one of the partners. You know, now I'm the majority owner of the company, but in the very beginning, you know, you want to consider other people's opinions. And, you know, my wife and I joke that we loved it so much that, you know, we paid for a large chunk of it first, and then we paid a lot for a large chunk of it the second time too. Honestly, for me, I knew that by making this brand company direct to consumer, different from any other traditional business, but really bring in this element of change, which is, you know, the internet is going to take over. And we're going to be different to where we're going to be the only company that won't sell through retail. We will only sell through our own factory webpage, through our own factory outlet, and truly be the only brand. And there is no other brand like us in the industry that is factory direct to consumer. There are brands that buy from factories. There are brands that are brand direct to consumer. So they'll buy from a factory, they'll import and they'll sell. But and there's also brands that have factories that also have retailers. But as far as where we are the only factory that sells direct to consumer. And that means that we avoid all of the middlemen in the equation, and we can deliver a better product to the end user at a better price. There's a challenge that goes along with all of that. We've been so incredibly successful in a short amount of time that we get incredibly backordered. And, you know, one of our challenges that we're trying to deal with right now with the thousands of orders that we receive, it's no longer a, you know, whether or not the brand will be successful, but now the challenge is on us to deliver the product in a timely manner. And that is, you know, where we've rolled out technology where people can track their orders online within what happens as they go through production. And you and I worked on that. You know, it's more staffing, it's bigger factories. And the thing is, this is different than tech. You know, tech, you can scale almost infinitely. The challenge with what we do is we're a factory and we make Maseratis and Corvettes and Ferraris in small batches. But, you know, the way that our business model works is we sell them at prices of a premium Ford. So it's a better product, but because we refuse to mark up our products the way that folks do in retail, we've got this guaranteed demand to where our, you know, production is backlogged until April. And, you know, the orders aren't stopping, right? The orders are still continuing. People are calling in daily. They're asking for status updates. Hey, I'd like to get my rod. I've been patient. I've been waiting. I really appreciate what you guys are doing. What we've done is something incredible. We have been able to, in the US, deliver a product that is a much better value than something that you can get as an import at roughly the same rate, a little bit more, but made here that takes care of the families that are local and near and dear to our hearts. And that has been kind of a unique thing that has happened in the fishing industry. The other part of the business that we do is we supply a lot of rod companies with the carbon fiber blanks that they buy from us. And then they end up making their own domestically made rods out of them.
Direct to consumer is a bold move. I mean, what that means is Alex shut down retail stores and supplying retail stores and went direct to consumer. He also did something else that was really unique. He didn't live on Amazon. So think this through. The pandemic hits last year. Companies that service their fulfillment through Amazon aren't able to get their product out because Amazon products take priority. So the customer service experience is diminished as the length of time it takes people to get their product is extended. It's not a problem Alex had to worry about because he's literally direct to consumer. You just go to their website. And this is a strategy that really has paid off for them. And I think we all like to be a part of a success story, don't we? We all like to be a part of someone who's building something in our home for us to use at home. So naturally, there are a lot of temptations that come. And those temptations come in the form of other people that want to provide products that have carbon fiber associated with them. Alex said that he's been approached many, many times to be a part of supplying some component or building some product out of carbon fiber. But they are very clear. They're not going to make the mistake of getting spread too far away from their primary flywheel, as Jim Collins would say, in Good to Great. They are focused on where they specialized, tubes.
We make tubular composites, and we are a specialist in something that is unique, which is a carbon fiber tube. And you know, it's funny, we get approached a lot by companies that are trying to get us to do products for them, and that they're not tubular shaped. You know, they can be flat panels, and we just flat out refuse to touch anything that is not a carbon fiber tube. And I joke with my wife and my employees sometimes that when I pass away, I'll probably be known as carbon fiber tube man, because, you know, we just refuse to touch anything that it's not a carbon fiber tube. You know, it can be a tapered tube, it can be a straight tube, but if it's a tube, we can make it in volume, we can make it here in the US, and we can make it incredibly cost competitive to something that our competitors can do. The other interesting thing that has happened, especially over the last year and a half, as the global supply chain became interrupted due to COVID, our demand shot through the roof, because suddenly there's a local company that can deliver products in a almost a timely manner. We're working on the timely manner part, but there's a local company that is not relying on, you know, heavy bulk ship imports from other locations that are coming into the US. And, you know, we got together with our team and we brainstormed. One of the ideas was, we're going to put, you know, like foolproof weather tents out in the parking lot, just because we don't have the space anymore inside of a facility, but we've got the order. So, you know, portable heaters, tents, something waterproof where we can just continue to make stuff, you know, through whatever's happening right now. And the entire sporting goods industry is up. Everybody wants to be outside. People are tired of being cooped up. And so it's been just a absolutely phenomenal year and a half for anything to do with fly fishing in the outdoors, or just fishing in general.
So you're getting it right. I mean, you're starting to understand that this is a very unique entrepreneur. Alex is creative and innovative and constantly learning, constantly, as he said earlier, staying paranoid in a productive way. So it's no surprise to learn that his company has taken off. It's growing like crazy. And really, this is the problem you want. But hear me when I say this. It's still a problem. Companies that grow too fast often will outpace their working capital and run out of money. They often will sell the promise of their product. Their customer will actually buy that promise. They'll order their product, but they can't have it. And there is a window from the moment they're excited about what they bought till the moment they decide, you are no longer taking care of me because I haven't got what I ordered. They go from jubilant to sour. And when people are sour, they tell everyone. So it is a fine balance managing the speed of growth and keeping your operations on pace with it. It's a hard one.
There are other companies that grow really, really fast in tech. And the part that's easy about tech is it can scale fairly quickly if you're, you know, building stuff in the cloud or whatnot. What cut us off guard when we came to the market and we said, look, we're going to make fishing rods products, but we're going to price them in a very transparent manner. You know, we're going to charge what it costs to stay in business. So we're going to charge, you know, whatever our profit margin is. And whatever the price ends up being, that's going to be the price. And we refuse to make the price higher or really do anything that will compromise the quality of what we make. So when we look at what our price waterfall is, a rod that would normally cost $800 at the store, we could sell to the consumer with the same components built here in the US for less than half that, just because we refuse to allow the retailer to mark up a rod so much. What that has happened is that is just amplified what our orders can do on a magnitude of several hundred. So in a very short period of time, and we've gone from a staff of six in a very small boutique factory to just a, you know, we're still a small company, but a staff of 60, and we have now offices in Europe and Russia and Australia, Japan, and now South Korea. Now these are sales offices, so we still manufacture everything in the US, We will ship items in bulk, and you know it's for the consumers to enjoy when they purchase locally. That way, they have their local support. They have local warranty. They've got local product knowledge. But you know the one thing that it took me a while to understand is it is incredibly difficult to grow as a company. One, not to outgrow your working capital. You know, as you are growing and you're this entrepreneur and you've got these orders rolling in, there is an issue where you're growing too fast. And the issue with you're growing too fast is your customers start to have a bad experience with you. They love the product. They love the quality of the rod that you're delivering. But you know, now suddenly, if it takes 5 months for somebody to receive a rod, believe me, they want your rod. But if they can't have something in which they can, you know, go to their fishing season with, they're going to buy a competitor's rod. And so, you know, for us, I think kind of in self-criticism, we gained a lot of market share. But we could have done it, again, in hindsight, if we would have slowed down and really focused on delivery, as opposed to, you know, our marketing engine is revving and we've got all these orders flying in and we're going to try to figure out how to manufacture as fast as possible, you know, in the current space that we have. So really the space came out of necessity. You know, we did move into a space, and by the time we got all the machinery situated, it was happening where the orders that we were receiving for the next month were more than all of the raw materials that all of our vendors had on hand for us for the next 5 months, right? So the issue was we bought all of the carbon fiber that was allotted to us, all the titanium that was allotted for our guides. And we would go back to our vendors and would say, hey, we'd like to put in a new purchase order and say, you guys are nuts. We've got nothing for the next 5 months and our own suppliers are overwhelmed. So now you're in this catch 22 where, you know, you're reveling in the success of taking market share. You know, you've got all these orders because the product is amazing, but you can't deliver. So, you know, what did we start doing? We started to vertically integrate. We started to buy companies and entities that manufactured grips. We started to buy suppliers that would manufacture the actual raw materials for us. Now, that is a challenge in itself because suddenly you're becoming an expert in something that you weren't intended to be an expert with overnight. But we needed to do that in order to be able to, and I don't even want to say more accurately project demand, but just to react a lot quicker to demand that's happening. One of the things that makes us an interesting company is that we can go from concept to full product in a matter of days. And right now, we really don't have to rely. There's a couple of components that we rely on. We're not a smelter, so we can't make our own titanium guides. But in terms of every other component, now it's manufactured in-house. So we make our own reel seats. We make our own handles, we make our own blanks, we do our own assembly. And really what that has done when COVID hit, right? I mean, you think that you're building for, you know, the future and future demand, and all of those components became instantly unavailable, except for us where we were making them in-house. So that allowed us to catch up. But in the very beginning, the challenge that we were having is the company was growing so fast. We were absolutely taking everything that our vendors had, that our suppliers had. And I think in hindsight, if I were to do things over again, I would tell my younger, more impatient self to slow down a bit. In terms of our production fallout, we believe as a company that we have to be stewards of the environment. We are in this industry, which is amazing. You know, we want to make sure that the various types of fish survive for the next generation. So when we talk about, you know, our blueprint, when we talk about what we're doing in terms of, you know, our products and innovation, you brought up the linen rod and you brought up, you know, various things in scrap rate. That comes out of, again, self-reflection as a company where, you know, we know that there are more materials available now than there were available 20 years ago. And linen happens to be one of those materials. It's still difficult to work with. It's still time consuming. But I believe that in the future, it'll be a product SKU that will take up a large part of our product portfolio because it is sustainable, because, you know, it does use environmentally friendly resins. It is something that can be manufactured on a massive scale. And then in terms of the production fallout that we were having, you know, we wanted to figure out what we can do with all these tubular composites that don't quite meet spec as they're coming out of our production. And oddly enough, there was a little company that came around that was recycling old golf shafts, and they were taking those old golf shafts and they were reclaiming them and they were making them into hiking sticks. So we shamelessly borrowed their business idea. And that translated into a business segment for us. And then we bought that company just because it felt right that they started the idea. They're called Indus Outdoors. And now we do anything with reclaimed golf shafts and parts that don't make it out of our production as well.
Remember that whole Alex is like a kid in a candy store dialogue we had earlier? That really is true. My wife and I were once visiting Alex and we were at his facility and he showed us a brand new line of hiking sticks that were made from cast off rejected tubes for fly rods. That's exciting. When you can sell the part of your product that doesn't meet your spec, but it can be adjusted and meet the spec for something else, essentially, you have capitalized your garbage. And these hiking sticks were anything but garbage. They were amazing. It was so fun to watch how thrilled he was. He is 100% in.
I have no plan B. When people talk about, you know, there's this cliche about burning the ship. We really did take all of our life savings that we had when we bought North Fork Composites, Composite Finish. I mean, I came to my wife and I said, hey, I know we've been working really, really hard. And I know that you want to buy a house. I'm sorry, we can't do that. We're gonna buy a company instead. And, you know, for the first couple of years, you know, when you go from hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary a year to under 40, things get incredibly sobering, right? The truth of the matter is, I don't know if it's more of, you know, if I don't win, I've got nothing to pay my bills with, or that I love it so much that drove it in the very beginning. You know, it's easy to look back when you're successful and you can say, hey, you know, things are great. This happened. But I think so many entrepreneurs fail because they're not fully, not just mentally, but just fully committed to whatever they're doing. You know, if you're one foot in, one foot out, it's so much easy to say, hey, I gave it a good try. Mm-hmm. I gave it a good go. And, you know, it was a battle well fought, and you can justify all of that. And you can say, hey, I'm going to, by the way, those Microsoft and Amazon recruiters know, they email you 3 months in, 6 months in, 9 months in, asking you how things are going. And if it's time to go back to the mothership, you know, they know that people will venture out, that people will start their companies, yeah, and they'll face challenges.
I really love this discussion of, I have no plan B. In an earlier podcast episode, we talked to hit songwriters Monty Pal and Anna Wilson. We've included a link to that episode in the show notes. It's the 8th episode of season 1, and it's well worth listening to. Monty told us about this conversation he had with Keith Urban, the amazing country songwriter, who said to him, Monty, I don't have a plan B. There is no plan B. I'm going to do this thing at whatever level it will have me. And one of the things that Monty and Anna pointed out, and I think you hear in Alex's story, is that people with a plan B just do plan B. A's the dream, but we're going to do B and we're going to dream of A. So when you are an entrepreneur like Alex, it's this combination of dreaming big, remaining paranoid, staying focused on innovation while not getting distracted into too many things that you could do but are different than your primary focus. I mean, there's a lot to it. And sometimes being an entrepreneur is a lonely place.
There's two things that I had to cope with. And one of them is, as the leader in your organization, you really don't have all the answers. And you think you do. Sometimes I think you deceive yourself that you do, just because you're in a position to make decisions. And very rarely do you come back to, you know, as iron sharpens iron, you know, kind of two people sharpen one another. But the one thing for sure, if somebody is looking for words of affirmation, don't go into entrepreneurship. You know, it's a very lonely place. It's a place that takes a lot of tenacity. And if people need that constant affirmation of, did I do this right? Is it going to be okay? It isn't, you know, a lot of times it isn't. And a lot of times it's going to be really, really hard. And when you think it's going to get hard, somebody's going to sue you and some of your key people are going to leave and it's going to get darker still. But I think if you're able to persevere and develop that tenacity, that's something truly special. And you know, people think that, you know, the most successful entrepreneurs are the ones that are billionaires. I promise you, the reason why I feel happy every single day is I don't have to report out to a board. I'm not saying that, you know, you can't be a happy person that's reporting out to a board. You absolutely can. But at the end of the day, I am completely content with, you know, where I am at this point in life. It's not to say that, you know, private equity isn't interesting or those options aren't in line for the future. But where I am right now, to the stage of where the company is, not to have any debt, not to have, you know, quarterly financial responsibilities like you do with a big company when you're reporting out to Wall Street, where your focus isn't just on this quarter, but your focus is 5, 7, 8, 12 years in advance. And I think when I look at it from that perspective, I really had to calm myself down that, you know, and retrain myself that this isn't an overnight thing. You know, you like to go into entrepreneurship to think, man, this is going to be great. I'm going to figure this business model out and it's going to be an autopilot. And it's, all I'm going to be doing is counting money. Well, the problem is the bigger the company gets, the bigger your receivables get, the bigger your bills get too. So, you know, it's kind of this vicious cycle that, you know, if you're not constantly building that tenacity, it tends to wear you out.
You know, if you're not careful, you're going to listen to Alex and just become horrified at being an entrepreneur. But that really is only going to be the people that aren't doing it. There's a group of you that are listening to this right now that have your hand over your heart and you're saying, yes, it's exactly what life is like for me. There's risk and there's uncertainty and there are competitors. There's all of those things. But that is the challenge that causes you to get up and face the day and go and exercise the demons. Weirdos like us love stuff like that. And so there really is this unique person that is the entrepreneur. It's not just having a great idea. It's this whole other chemistry. And Alex actually described it as sort of psycho.
In order to be a good entrepreneur, you have to be a little bit of a psychopath. And I mean that in the most kindest of ways. You just have to block certain things out. You know, it's not that they don't affect you, they do, but you realize that you can't function if you let those things just constantly weigh on you. You know, there's a speaker that talks about, you know, men compartmentalizing things and putting stuff into boxes. I think you genuinely have to put it in a box and lock it away until where you need to open it. Like, you know, hey, this is the time that unfortunately I have to think about this. And the worst part about that is it affects your mood. You know, and depending on what type of personality you are, if you let things affect your mood, it does affect your overall vision. It affects your ability to motivate people. It affects your ability to, you know, make sound decisions. So I have no better answer aside from the fact that, you know, when I get home every single day, if my wife asks me how things went, I will just sit there for a half an hour and just, I don't want to relive it. I've already lived it once. You know, I'll just tell her the good stuff and I won't bother her with the really tough stuff. You know, she's got a lot of things that are happening in her daily life, but I think you just have to block it out. I haven't been able to, you know, if you've got some advice for me, aside from, hey, Alex, I think truly you're a psychopath, but I think I got to put it in a box and just forget about it.
I really think this is a skill. I don't know that it's natural. At least for me, it certainly wasn't. This ability to only apply the necessary mental and emotional resources to a challenge that challenge requires. Because what I want to do naturally is stop everything and fret like crazy over that challenge. And that really doesn't help me, and it certainly doesn't help those around me. I want you to write this down. It's not a crisis until it's a crisis. I asked Alex, how do you keep people engaged, and how do you keep them moving through their challenges?
I think most importantly, they have to know that they are doing this not just for me, but also for their own future. Everybody that's involved here is the reason why I was able to afford North Fork is I was bonused handsomely working at Amazon and Microsoft. Those companies do it well. And we follow the same pattern here. We make sure that people are, that they understand that they are financially rewarded when things go well. And, you know, things don't necessarily always go well, but I think that's a giant motivator. I mean, they're bartering their time for money, but they're also bartering it for a chance to create something that hasn't been done before. So I think it's a mix of both. It's, hey, you're learning a whole bunch of stuff, but also you're being properly rewarded for something that is happening. So, you know, making your, something as simple as making your financial statements available for people to see. And I'm not saying, you know, making it available to see for, you know, every single person in production, but, you know, your management team, your marketing team, your supervisors, you know, there is a cost to a increase in fallout. And the cost is, this is how much it's going to cost less in bonuses. You know, you may think that that information is privy to you, but if you make that information available to them, you know, you find that there's this shared burden of responsibility, because I can't run around the factory, you know, figuring out where we're wasting carbon or whatever's happening, but they can look out for that in their everyday task. And then it rolls back up because they know it's gonna have an impact on their overall equity. So I would say, you know, make people profit partners.
I thoroughly enjoy talking to Alex. I have loved every minute I've been able to spend with this incredible business owner, this born entrepreneur. I really appreciated the way that he speaks about it's important that we learn how to compartmentalize the challenges. He's been through some really big ones. So have I, and I'm betting so have you. We learned from Alex that as an entrepreneur, you've got to be tough and you've got to be innovative. But could you hear the fun in his story? I heard it over and over again as he would seek solutions. Notice also the way that he looks at his people. The last thing he's just said to us is find a way to make them profit partners. In fact, when he talked about the company that they purchased that was making the golf shafts, he said it felt like the right thing to do because they'd given us the idea. Alex is a person that, as big as his vision is, he's always looking at, how do I take care of others? Which I think is part of the key to his success. Well, there you have it, folks. If you're a business leader and you'd like to know what hiring a coach would look like for you and your organization, head over to mymapscoach.com and let's set up a meeting. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us an honest review. We read every one of them. It really helps us in our mission to help others. I hope you've enjoyed our time together, and I hope you'll join us next time as we continue to explore the stories of extraordinary individuals who choose difficult.